The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. We love FreshBooks. For freelancers and small business owners, FreshBooks takes the pain out of accounting. If you have a question about the service, there's a real live human who will answer every call in about three rings. You can get a 30-day free trial by going to FreshBooks.com/SIMedia and enter SI Media. That's FreshBooks for freelancers and small business owners. FreshBooks takes the pain out of accounting.
Basically, I would think if I missed a touchdown, that would be my entire day would be ruined. If something happened where I was on a crowd shot or I directed a camera to, hey, find me Gary Kubiak on the far sideline, and the camera's looking for him, and I say, no, you just passed him, and no, go back. And meanwhile, I don't notice, but a team runs to the line of scrimmage and runs a play and scores a touchdown or throws a long pass, and you know come in the middle of it, you JIP it, join in progress. And the receiver's already running down the sideline because he's caught it. That would be my worst nightmare. I'm always amazed at the proposition bets in Las Vegas. How many times will they show X or Y or something like that? And I remember one year it was somebody and I thought, well, that should be the under because I don't even know where they're sitting.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we talk to members of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim. And this week we have an excellent guest. It's Mike Arnold, who is directing Super Bowl 50. Mike Arnold is a longtime CBS Sports director, very acclaimed, very accomplished. This will be his fourth Super Bowl that he's directing. He's been part of 11 Super Bowls, going all the way back to being a broadcast assistant on a John Madden, Pat Summerall Super Bowl. Mike Arnold as well directed the famed Leitner game. So that Duke-Kentucky NCAA tournament game where Leitner catches the pass from Grant Hill, turns and hits the shot that heads him into history, that one of arguably the greatest game of all time in college basketball. Mike Arnold was the guy who directed that. Mike Arnold's also directed Olympics as well. Really interesting guy in broadcasting. You never hear from him because he's a behind-the-scenes guy, but he is the person who would be bringing you the pictures for Super Bowl 50. He's had a very, very busy week in Santa Clara, but I appreciate him carving out about 40 minutes or so for us. I think you're going to find this interesting. In particular, if you are a student who's in broadcast, this guy has one of the premier jobs in the business. There's only been 50 Super Bowls, and he's someone who's directed four of them. So, you know, among the big jobs in sports broadcasting. All right, and as promised, we bring in Mike Arnold, who will direct this year's Super Bowl. As I said at the top, this is the fourth Super Bowl Mike Arnold has directed, and I'm excited to talk to him because we, generally speaking, have had broadcasters and writers and reporters on this podcast so far, a couple behind-the-scenes people, and it's very cool to get the person who's going to be directing what could end up being the most watched television program in history. Mike Arnold, you are somewhere in San Francisco. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks very much, Richard. Happy to be here.
Or maybe you're in Santa Clara. You're somewhere in California, I should say.
I'm actually in San Jose right now.
San Jose. So eventually, if I got my sands, I would have. You're not at the Sands in Vegas, but you're some sand something. All right, Mike, just to start off with, to introduce people to what the director of the Super Bowl would do, or what a director of a major sports event would do, what are your primary responsibilities this Sunday?
My primary responsibilities are I help to decide what you see at home. I'm in charge of all the live pictures. I direct the cameras, what to shoot during the game. And with Lance Barrow, Lance is the producer. Lance handles the replays and he kind of scopes the overall theme of the broadcast as the producer. And I like to think that he's the head coach and I'm the quarterback. I execute what he wants to do.
Would you say, Mike, you have a directing style? And if you do, what is that style?
I don't know that I have a directing style. I just think that I try to put the viewer in the best seat of the house. I just try to think, if I'm a viewer, what would I want to see now? And try to direct that way.
How does the Super Bowl for you differ from, well, let's take this multiple fold. How does the Super Bowl for you differ from the AFC Championship?
Well, it differs in that we've got a lot more cameras, some of which will never get on the air other than replays, but you're looking at a lot more monitors. But for example, in the AFC Championship game, we may have had 30 cameras or 40 cameras, and now at the Super Bowl, we have 70. That includes pylon cameras. We've got cameras in each pylon on the goal line, the back line of the end zone. So those are 16 cameras right there. So you've got a lot more equipment, a lot more firepower at the Super Bowl than even the AFC Championship game.
And what would be the difference between how this job would be different from, let's say, week 8 of the NFL season?
Again, it's more cameras that week 8 in the NFL season, maybe you've got one camera that covers all the receivers to the far side. And in this game, maybe you've got two cameras or three cameras. So you can have a lot more specialty type shots. Maybe you've got some defensive isolates or replays that you wouldn't have in the regular season that you'll have in the Super Bowl.
Can you take us into, you work at in a production truck. So let's get a couple of specifics on this. Where during Super Bowl 50, where physically will you be?
Physically during Super Bowl 50, I'm outside the stadium in the big TV compound, which is right near the loading dock of Levi's Stadium. And I sit in a big 18-wheeler semi-truck that has all sorts of TV monitors on it. And that's the control room there. And we make our decisions from there. It's a huge television compound with the production truck where I sit with all the monitors. There's the videotape truck. There's the audio truck. There's video. It's just a mass of mobile units. It looks like a little semi-trailer truck stop out there.
And in terms of, Mike, during the game, if you could, take us into your seat. What are you – you're staring at a bank of cameras and or a bank of video screens, and if so, how many video screens would you be monitoring at once?
Yeah, I'm staring at a bank of video screens, probably about 45, and I arrange them kind of high to low, where the regular play-by-play cameras are on the upper level. The cameras like the cart that goes along the sideline or the low end zone, they're on the middle level. And the mini cameras, the guys who run around with the camera on their shoulders on the field, who get the close-ups of players on the bench, you know, waving to the camera or something like that, they're on the bottom row. So I know that if we're going to a play-by-play shot, I kind of look up at the top row, and after a touchdown, if I'm looking for a bench shot or something, then I go to the bottom row. So that's how I kind of arrange the cameras on the monitor wall.
This is a layman's question, and obviously you've done this for years, but how does the brain process all those cameras? I mean, it strikes me that there's so much, it's almost would be impossible to see the whole field, even if you have cameras on the whole field. So how does your brain process all that data?
I think I work by almost process of elimination that, again, I've got the cameras geographically positioned, and I know, for example, if it's a long pass to the near sideline, I can look lower left on my monitor wall for after the catch when the guy goes out of bounds, or it's incomplete and maybe the players tumble out of bounds. There should be a mini down there, the camera on a guy's shoulder. So I kind of geographically locate them, so immediately my eye goes to that position. Mm. Because I don't think anybody could look at 40 cameras all at once and process all that information. I mean, sometimes I'm amazed when you go to a restaurant and you've got 8 people who order, and somebody doesn't want salad with tomatoes, and somebody wants their meat with, well done, but not too well done. And the waiter doesn't write it down. And I'm thinking, how does he get all that, you know, for 8 people and not writing it down? So I guess everybody's got a skill, and this is mine.
Are good sports television directors born or made?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I think it's probably a combination of the both. I think you can probably have a natural gift for it. And I think you can learn by experience and get better every time you do it. I would probably think that I might be the latter. I didn't start out trying to be a television director. I just kind of fell into it when somebody said, I don't have any producing jobs, but I'll let you direct if you want to direct 5 games this year, back in my younger days. And he said, can you direct? And I said, oh, sure, I can do that. And I'd never directed a thing in my life.
When was that? But what year did this all start?
I think that was 1985. When that started. 1 year I was 1982, I was supposed to produce some NFL games. I think I probably would have been one of the youngest producers ever to produce an NFL game, and then they went out on strike. And then the next couple of years I worked on the NFL Today, and then that spot opened up where I thought maybe I'd go back to being a producer, and my boss said, well, I don't really have any producer's jobs, but I've got some director's jobs open, and you know, can you do it? Oh, yeah, sure, I can do that. And luckily, they started me out with 4 cameras and 2 videotape machines, and I grew from there. If I would have had more, I'd probably be digging ditches right now.
So we have your background. When did you start at CBS?
I started in 1981 as a broadcast associate, which I was responsible for all the electronic graphics you saw on the screen. So I kid around, 16 Joe Montana, or Joe Montana has thrown for 300 yards today, or his stats, 19 completions, 28 attempts, all the written information on the screen I was responsible for. And the announcers were Pat Summerall and John Madden. And I remember meeting John Madden in the summer. We did the Albany Timber Carnival in Albany, Oregon. And I said, John, I'm just starting out. You know, I'm doing the graphics. What do you need? And John said, if you can just get me average yards on first down, you'll be a hit. So I went into every game thinking, okay, I better come up with average yards on first down. Because at the time, you know, John thought that was a big key to victory. And it was on from there.
Did you get to a point where you eventually were the director for Madden and Summerall?
No, I never directed a football game with Pat and John. The highest I ever got was I was a replay director on Super Bowls that CBS was involved in. You know, one of 3 replay directors with Bob Stenner and Sandy Grossman.
Yeah, I mean, obviously 2 guys who are sort of legendary figures in the business. Do you have a sense as in terms of a director? And this is not a specific to necessarily Jim or Phil or Al and Chris, but what do you think are the traits, or what do you think would be the reasons for a broadcast team to remain current, relevant, on the top of their game for years and years and years, as someone like Madden and Summerall did?
I think first and foremost, they have to love the game. I think they've got to enjoy doing the work, reading about the teams, getting all the pertinent information, talking to the players and coaches when they get out on site. When it becomes drudgery and it's not fun anymore, then it's probably time to hang it up. And all the people you mentioned, I think, still love the job, and that's part of why they're successful.
You know, it's always interesting to me, Mike, and eventually I'll get to sort of what your game week is during the Super Bowl, because I think listeners will find that interesting. But you know, I know how broadcasters are judged, either by your bosses internally and obviously by the public or people who write about the media. But it's different for producers and directors, because you're not going to see a lot of people, you know, on social media talking about the directing of a certain game or the producing of a game. So how are you judged in your work? Is it Sean McManus, David Burson, Harold Bryan, et cetera, make a subjective decision on your performance, or is it something else?
I think that's probably it. I mean, it's subjective. I mean, Sean, David, Harold, Steve Karasik, I mean, they may like something that I do 1 week, and then the next week they don't like it. It's like when you go to watch a film and you like the film and I don't like the film. So it's very subjective. I wish you could quantify it. But I don't know that you can. It's not like with an announcer how you can say, well, he said this or something like that. Or there are certain things that you can probably quantify, but it's hard to do. It's very subjective. I think if I can give you credit for a little bit, I'm always pleased when you write something about a researcher at ESPN or CBS Sports got video of a seventh round draft pick that somebody, some team picked from the University of Yugoslavia or something like that. And boy, that's a great tip of the cap for a young person like that, or a feature that it's really the producer who's lived in, and it's their vision of the feature. And some talent is very involved in it, but some talent, because of their schedule, may just walk in, ask the list of questions that are handed to them. And, you know, everybody thinks, boy, that was a great piece by so-and-so. And it was, but it's really the producer's vision on that feature. And I think you're one of the guys who recognizes that. And I think a lot of people in the TV industry appreciate it.
I appreciate that. You mentioned that because one of the things I really enjoy is sort of putting the spotlight on people who are never written about. And maybe, you know, when you work on the print or digital side, you know, you have a sense of what producers do because you're sort of grinding it yourself. And so I appreciate what people in production do very much, in fact. All right. One of the things, Mike, that we do on this podcast always is we give people a sense of how they go about preparing for their job. So as best as you can, and I think it's an interest. The reason I wanted to talk to you this week, obviously, is because it's the Super Bowl. And I'll just sit back and you can go as long as you want. Can you give the listeners a sense of what your Monday through Sunday will be? And can you take us up right to kickoff in terms of what your responsibilities and preparation are?
Wow, I don't know you've got enough time in the podcast for that.
It's infinite space, Mike. We can go forever.
I'll give it a shot. Well, it probably started maybe last Saturday, where I review the AFC Championship game and what did I do well, what didn't I do well. Phil and Jim were talking about Peyton Manning, and I had a shot at Gary Kubiak. You know, how could I better support them? Little things that I'll watch during the game, maybe like, boy, somebody's holding up a sign behind the Broncos bench, and I wonder what that is. And maybe at the meeting later in the week, I'll say, hey, you guys hold up a sign. And they'll say, well, we're alerting the defense to how many wide receivers are in the game or something like that. And I think, boy, is that something that'll translate to TV? Do I want to show that on the air? Is Phil interested in talking about that? So that was Saturday. I'll watch the last Denver game. Then Sunday, I watched the last Panthers game on TV. Obviously, Carolina, Arizona on Fox. And I admire Rich Russo and Richie Zients' work. They do a great job. And I try to pick up little things again. I haven't seen Carolina much this year. We did them on Thanksgiving against Dallas. And I like to see, well, are they running no huddle? Do they run read option? What formations may give cameramen problems or camera people problems? So I'll watch that game on Sunday. Monday, I start reading everything that I can on the internet about both teams, and I memorize the Carolina Panthers roster. I've got a pretty good handle on Denver, but I memorize all the names and numbers. This way, if Phil says, boy, that's a great play by Jonathan Stewart, I tell the cameraman he's talking about 28 black or white, because a lot of times the cameramen don't see color in their viewfinders that they look through. I mean, most days they do now, but I'm still old school where the cameramen used to not see colors. It was just black or white. So Carolina will wear black or dark uniforms. So I'll say, hey, he's talking about 28 black, or Cam Newton, he's talking about one. This way the cameramen know, or an offensive lineman, Ryan Khalil threw a good block to spring Jonathan Stewart. Hey, camera two, give me 67 black. So I memorize all Carolina's roster. Then I memorize Denver's roster. And, that's the way I do it. I think it's interesting that Lance would probably do it the other way, that Lance would see a wide receiver make a catch, and he sees that 88 made a catch, and he can tell filler Jim Demaryius Thomas, or somebody recovers the ball and Lance can say, Brandon Roby recovered the ball because he sees the number and knows the name. I do it the other way because I react to the name and give the camera people the number. So I memorize the names and numbers. And then I start also gathering tape that I want to show the camera people for a Friday camera meeting. So I want to show the camera people some read option plays that Carolina does, some Denver bunch routes that they may do, just so the camera people are familiar with it. I mean, we've got the best in the business, but just to make sure that all the little nuances are covered. So I put together plays that I think are going to be germane, and I pick plays from other games that I think, hey, if the quarterback is outside the tackle box, we want to have a replay from here and make sure that the people who do the first down line and the tackle box enhanced graphic look, that they're familiar with this. So I start to composite plays that I want to show the cameraman. Yesterday we went out to the trucks and we looked at the booth design, what the booth is going to look like and what the backdrop's going to look like. We just kind of what I would call dry blocked the MVP pregame ceremony. There was a meeting at the NFL offices about the format. Okay, this is what's going to happen from 6 o'clock to 6:35, and what the commercial breaks will be and things like that. Today, Wednesday, we're going to watch the Broncos practice, and I go with, again, Lance Barrow, the producer, Jim and Phil, Tracy Wolfson, who's the reporter on the Broncos sideline, and her producer, Amy Samuelson. We'll go out there and watch practice and then talk to players and coaches afterwards. Thursday, we'll do the same thing with Carolina. We'll watch their practice. Evan Washburn is the producer there, is the reporter there. Andy Friedman's the producer. So they'll go out there instead of Tracy and Amy. We'll watch Carolina's practice, talk to their players. Friday, we start at 7 a.m. We've got a camera meeting from 7 to 8. And 8:30, 7:30, and we'll show. I'll come out with a preliminary ISO chart that, okay, camera one, when you're not play by play, these are your responsibilities, and go all the way down the list for all the cameras. I'll show that tape that I had worked on about, hey, let's be familiar with Carolina's read option. Let's make sure that, you know, when Cam Newton scores, he's going to celebrate. So make sure we got a camera here when he celebrates. And then after the camera meeting, we'll rehearse the post-game trophy presentation. We'll rehearse the Walter Payton Man of the Year. We'll rehearse the team introductions. We'll rehearse the honoring the past Super Bowl MVPs, the national anthem, America the Beautiful. And then after we do all that, we've got a high school team that's going to come out and probably work for an hour to 90 minutes on the field that will run some plays for us, and it'll give the camera people a chance to fine-tune their isolation patterns, let video take a look at what the field's going to look like at 3:35 Pacific, 6:35 Eastern, and give the videotape or the Elvis people chances to record plays, play them back. Hey, here's a foot on the line. Make sure we freeze it there when the person's foot is on the line. So we'll do that Friday. Saturday is a pretty light day. I think Phil and Jim may meet with the officials. I'll go out to the stadium again and have one last little camera meeting about any problems or anything I think we can do better on. And then Sunday is the game.
That's interesting. I appreciate the details there. A couple of follow-ups, or maybe not even follow-ups, a sort of additive information. What is the truck like, or I should say, what is your production truck like day of the game? Is it loud? Is it quiet? And who's talking?
I like to think the production truck is kind of organized chaos. when you go in there, it may seem like a bunch of people are you know, yelling and screaming, or maybe that's not the right term, but I mean, Lance is talking, he's talking to the announcers, he's talking to graphics, he's talking to videotape. I'm talking to the camera people. Meanwhile, in my headset, I've got the camera people in my headset and the announcers in my headset. You know, again, Sean, Harold, David Burson, Steve Karasik, they may have a thought, so they may be saying something to Lance. The technical director who pushes all the buttons, he may say to me, hey, how are we going to go to break? Are we going to have an Elvis rollout or something like that? Corey Fishman is talking to the – Corey's the associate director. He's talking to the red hat on the field about after this punt, we want a commercial. Or where he may tell the audio guy and tell me, we're going to play this music to commercial. Last week, we, you know, with Glenn Frey passing, I think we had an Eagles song. So Corey will tell me and he'll tell the audio person. So there's a lot of people talking, but you kind of tune out what you don't need to know and try to listen in on the things you really need to focus on.
For the listeners, who is the red hat?
The red hat is the person on the field from the NFL who actually signals the commercials. So we have a person on the field who tells the red hat, we want to take a commercial after the punt. And then the red hat on the field signals to the officials that TV wants a commercial, and the officials can either agree to it or deny it. So a lot of times on a momentum play where somebody punts the ball, you receive it at your own 30 and run it back to the opposition 20, they're going to wave off the commercial. Even if you need a commercial, they're not going to let you have it because there's a change of momentum play. So the NFL does control that. TV doesn't control it. So a lot of times we're trying to get to commercial fast because we only have a certain amount of time in the commercial window. And if we linger, we may miss something on the other side. They may start to play on the other side. So that's what the red hat does.
Interesting. I appreciate you explaining that. What's the worst nightmare for an NFL television director? What for you is just, if this happens, your entire day is ruined?
I would say that basically I would think if I missed a touchdown, that would be my entire day would be ruined. Yeah. If something happened where I was on a crowd shot or I directed a camera to, hey, find me Gary Kubiak on the far sideline, and the camera's looking for him. And I say, no, you just passed him, and no, go back. And meanwhile, I don't notice, but a team runs to the line of scrimmage and runs a play and scores a touchdown or throws a long pass, and you know, come in the middle of it, you JIP it, join in progress, and the receiver's already running down the sideline because he's caught it. That would be my worst nightmare.
The guest is Mike Arnold, the director of Super Bowl 50 and a longtime and accomplished director for CBS Sports. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with Mike right after this. All over America, people are counting down to a huge event that demands everyone's attention. No, it is not the Super Bowl. It is not the 2016 presidential election. It is tax day. For a better way to manage your books and make tax season easy, try FreshBooks, a cloud accounting software designed exclusively for service-based small business owners. It's the personal accountant you've always needed, right in your pocket. We like FreshBooks. FreshBooks is fast. You can create and send an invoice in just 30 seconds. That easy. Easy for customers to pay online, and FreshBooks clients get paid 5 days faster than average. If you have a question about the service, FreshBooks will answer every call basically in 3 rings or so. It is a customer-friendly service place for sure. Contact their award-winning support team and get help from real-life humans. Every call answered in about 3 rings. No, I'll get back to you. No automation hell. They are helpful at the drop of a hat. From landscapers to web designers, your time is better spent at quarterback than on the offensive line. FreshBooks does all the heavy lifting on invoicing, expenses, and taxes. Right now, FreshBooks is offering my listeners 30 days of unrestricted use, totally free. You don't need a credit card to sign up. How do you do that? To get this 30-day free trial of FreshBooks, just go to FreshBooks.com/SIMedia and enter SI Media in the How You Heard About Us section. That's FreshBooks.com/SIMedia. Enter the promo code SI Media, FreshBooks.com. Try it out today. We appreciate them sponsoring the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, back with Mike Arnold, and we appreciate his time. All right, Mike, a couple more for you. You know, this year, people in the television business are always aware of what's written and what's being said on social media. And this year, Phil Sims and Mike Carey have really gotten a lot of criticism, both from viewers through social media and certainly through some people who cover the industry. You are removed from the announcers, but at the same time, you are an intricate part of this unit. You know, you, Lance, Jim, Phil, Mike Carey, Tracy, whoever else is there. So how do you react to criticism of your announcers or your announcing team, even if no one is saying anything about the direction or the production?
Well, I think you notice it, and it would be like if somebody's criticizing your wife or your son or your brother. I mean, we live together. I think this will be our 31st game together. We did the Thursday night package and Sunday, and certainly we travel together. We're like a big family, so you never like to see anybody, suffer any criticism. So, it makes you sad to see somebody suffer that kind of criticism.
In terms of, to give the listeners a little bit of a sense of what the learning curve is like for someone like Mike Carey, who had no broadcast experience coming into a national broadcast, what is that learning curve like for someone like Mike?
You know, honestly, I don't really know. I mean, it can't be easy. That would probably be a question that would be better served to ask Mike. I mean, I don't know. Luckily, I don't have to do it. I think if I had to do it, I'd be panhandling on the street because that's not my forte. But that's probably a better question to ask Mike what that learning curve is like.
Fair. Asked and answered. I appreciate that. How do you determine as the director, if you're indeed determining this, or maybe Lance does, how many times, let's say, to show an owner on the side, owner in the owner's box, or a famous person who's in the stands?
I think it's a combination of Lance and myself, what's right, what we feel like what's right or not. I'm always amazed at the proposition bets in Las Vegas.
Exactly.
How many times will they show right. X or Y or something like that? And I remember one year it was somebody and I thought, well, that should be the under because I don't even know where they're sitting. So, yeah, I think Lance and I get together and we'll kind of figure that out.
As a philosophy, how much do you like crowd shots, whether it's a fan in the stands crying, a kid celebrating beyond no return? If it's, if you're not doing the NFL, let's say you're doing college, students going crazy. What do you think as a director? How much does the crowd or the scenery add to the game production?
I think the crowd adds something. I'm kind of in the middle of it. I think obviously if you direct college football, it's a great scene. I mean, we've got the SEC and at CBS and the pictures with the cheerleaders and the sea of colors. I think that's great. I think when you do a Steelers game, you've got all the terrible towels waving. So I think that's great. I think at the Super Bowl, it'll probably be a little less. You know, it's not that wild scene. Not to say that there won't be crowd shots. I know our president, Sean McManus, he might say to me on a big third down play like last week in Denver when it's third and 10 for New England and now the Denver crowd rises as one and they're yelling and screaming. You know, Sean likes to say, I hear the crowd, but, you know, I'd like to see the crowd also. So I think, you know, judicious crowd shots add to the broadcast. I don't think you want to overdo it, but I think if you use them judiciously, I think you're well served by it.
Mike, you've done college before, and I'm going to ask you about one of the most famous games in the history of college athletics that you happen to be directing, and that was the 1992 East Regional Final between Duke and Kentucky. That is the famous Christian Laettner last-second basket for Duke. Mike Arnold directing that with Vern Lundquist on the call. Mike also directed the he was in Lillehammer for CBS, and I believe, if I'm right, when Dan Jansen won the gold medal, Mike was on. Mike directed that. Herman Myers' Crash, Mike was the director on. He directed some baseball playoffs and obviously four Super Bowls and some incredible things that we've seen in the NFL. But one last thing, Mike, on just sort of the crowd shots, and I think you'd just be a fascinating person to ask, but as a director and as someone who directs at the highest level, when you, let's say, are watching ESPN and you're seeing just time and time again, they're showing like co-eds and college women and like 5,000 shots of like a blonde woman from Clemson. Do you smile or are you like, man, these guys are just going just a little bit too far with titillation and sexuality?
I don't know. It depends if I'm interested in the game or not. You know, again, I think when they're apropos, I think it adds to the broadcast. I think you just have to walk a fine line and not overdo it.
Let's take the Super Bowl 50. What do you want at the end of a game? Let's say the final play of the Super Bowl is a catch in the left corner of the end zone. As a director, what do you need to happen in terms of your camera people?
I think obviously we want to see replays of the catch. You know, if it's close to the boundary or the sideline, was it a good catch? I mean, were his feet in bounds? Did he possess the ball all the way through the catch? You know, I'd love to see Cam Newton's reaction or Peyton Manning's reaction, Ron Rivera's reaction maybe, or Gary Kubiak's reaction. I want to document the play and then maybe see if there's any reaction with the key participants. And there might not be. Some of those guys are just so stoic that there's not reaction. But you could say no reaction is a reaction. So I want to be able to document the play and add to it with, you know, judicious shots of players, you know, like Cam Newton or if he threw it, or Peyton Manning who's watching, or vice versa.
One of the things that I'm always impressed by, people like you, and you mentioned the Fox crew of Rich Russo and Richie Zions. This would be the same for NBC's Top Crew, Goodell and Drew Asikoff, ESPN's as well. The best people in the business, they understand how to lay out, which means how to be silent when the director is going from cut to cut to cut to cut after the game, and eventually we see replays. When, Mike, at the end of a game, when something incredible happens, are you and or Lance telling, let's say, Jim and Phil not to talk so you can go a minute and a half of just crowd noise and the cuts that you do? Or are they making the decision on their own? I'm always fascinated by historic end of game situations because I always think silence is like so important for the viewer, and I tend to see the best production crews in the business understand that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Fred and Drew, Jay Rothman and Chip Dean at ESPN. I mentioned Rich and Rich at Fox. I think it's a combination. I think great announcers know when saying nothing is the best choice of words, if that makes sense. And sometimes Lance or you know, another producer might say, lay out here, because he recognizes it's a big scene. So I think it's a combination between the great announcers knowing when to lay out, or they may have just a quick little line that adds to that picture. But I think the great ones sense it, like, you know, like the people you mentioned. And sometimes the producer may chime in and say, hey, let's lay out and listen here.
All right, Mike, I want to finish up with this Duke-Kentucky game, and you could certainly tell me if there's a game. I will ask you what you think the greatest game you've ever directed, but Duke-Kentucky, for college basketball fans, was just an epic experience. It is arguably the greatest college basketball game in the history of that sport. As the director, can you take me into the booth when Grant Hill was on the sidelines about to make that long pass to Leitner, who eventually fake turned around and hit that game winner. What was going through your mind? What did you want to capture? And I think in terms of the direction, you got it, because that scene of Leitner making the shot and then putting his arms up and his team enveloping him is, you know, it's etched in college basketball fans' minds.
Yeah, I always think I hate Christian Leitner. I still hate Christian Leitner on that ESPN 30 for 30. Right. You know, I remember we got lucky that they called a timeout and Grant Hill came out and Craig Silver was the producer, and he made sure that we had the mini under the far basket, under the basket that Grant Hill threw the pass from, that we had the mini covering the play and not shooting a bench or something like that. So we had a great shot, obviously, of you know, the baseball pass to Leitner, and then Richard, as you said, Leitner running kind of back at that camera with his arms up and then being enveloped by all his teammates. And we were lucky enough to say, hey, two, you've got the Duke bench, and three, you've got the Kentucky bench, and you know, six, you've got Patino on that. So I really felt like we had all our bases covered. The one thing I remember, my favorite shot of that actually is, not that you asked, but was Thomas Hill crying. And I thought the first shot after Leitner hit it was I cut to the Duke bench and I saw Thomas Hill crying. And in that split second where I took the shot, he turned his back to the camera. And I remember thinking, you know, what goes through your mind in the split second, I thought, this is an unbelievable game, and I might have just screwed this up, taking a shot of the back of a kid's head. And I just stayed with it and thought, well, I'm gonna stay with it. And if he doesn't turn around again, I'm gonna hate myself. And luckily he turned around and he said, oh my God, oh my God. And I remember thinking, I always wanted to ask Thomas Hill, all the players ran onto the court and he stayed on the bench. And I thought, why didn't he run on the court with all the players? I mean, I've always wanted to ask him. He was the only guy there who just stayed on the bench and cried. And I always think about that because everybody talks about the Leitner shot and his arms upraised. And, hey, that was a great shot. But I think about Thomas Hill and how close I thought I was to, boy, I really butchered this. And then to me, it's a great shot of him turning around in tears saying, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah, that's a great recollection, obviously, and an iconic shot of Thomas Hill. Is there one broadcast that you consider your finest directing moment, either for something you did or just because you were part of that event?
You know, you mentioned a couple of the things I've been a part of, lucky to be a part of. I mean, Duke Kentucky, I probably would be my number one memory. I'll never forget that the Olympics in 94, the speed skating with Dan Jansen, that here he was in his best event, the 500, you know, hoping to medal and slipped and finished out of the medals portion of it, and then coming back in the 1,000, which wasn't his best event, and everybody thinking, you know, he'll be lucky to finish in the top 10 and win it, and winning the gold medal there. That was an unbelievable moment. Those are the two things off the top of my head that I can remember. I mean, we've had some unbelievable NCAA basketball tournament games. Let's see. Obviously, Duke, Kentucky. We had an Arizona, Illinois game where I can't even remember. Somebody led by like 14 or 19 with 4 minutes to go, and the game went to overtime. That was a great game. We had Florida Gulf Coast about 3 or 4 years ago.
Georgetown, right? The upset.
Right over Georgetown, the first week in San Diego State. So, the great thing about being at CBS, you're going to get a shot at a lot of high quality events. And every once in a while, you're going to catch lightning in a bottle and it's going to be memorable. And I'm lucky to be a part of a lot of those.
All right, Mike, here's my final question. I told you I'd get you out of here fairly soon. I know you have a very busy week. I'm going to give you the option to be the director for any sporting event in history. What event do you choose and why?
Boy, any sporting event in history.
Yeah.
Boy, you're putting me on the spot here, and I'm probably not thinking of something. I'd say if I was a bigger soccer fan, maybe like the World Cup soccer final.
I'm looking for a specific something that happened. Like I'm letting you do Jesse Owens Berlin 36 or the 58 NFL championship game.
Oh my God!
So it's even a bigger question.
God, you stumped me here. You're definitely going to lose. You're going to lose. You're going to lose listeners.
Could be boxing. Could be Ali Frazier. Could be sport is basketball. It could be Jordan.
I don't know. I mean,
three.
Yeah. I mean, Ali Frazier. I mean, like you said, Jesse Owens in the Olympics. Anything? Bobby Thompson's home run.
51. Yeah.
Don Larson's perfect game. I mean, I'm a baseball fan. I'm living in New York. The 69 Mets.
Those are all good.
Yeah, what would be the biggest one?
You want to do the 1919 Black Sox? That'd be interesting.
I'm not going to go there. That wouldn't be big. You know, it might not resonate, but I think something I grew up in as a Jets fan and Super Bowl III,
right.
Joe Namath winning and the iconic shot of Namath walking off, you know, with his right hand in the air. I mean, that would have been special for me just because I was a Jets fan. Baseball, I mean, Kirk Gibson's home run.
Those are good ones. NBC had Kirk Gibson. Super Bowl
right.
Was Super Bowl III a CBS or an NBC? I think it was NBC.
I think Super Bowl III was NBC.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Those are
good. All right, we won't put you on the spot anymore because those. But those are all good. And you have a big
do
one.
I lose Go ahead. Do I lose points because I didn't actually answer? I mean, I gave a bunch of them. Maybe can I call you back in 2 hours after I really noodle it in my mind and think about which was the best one?
No, you can. We're leaving it here. I'm the director on this, Mike, and I like when it's organic, even if it's not perfectly clean.
Okay.
So we're leaving you here. Plus, you have a very big week. You're directing Super Bowl 50. One of only a handful of people who've gotten to direct the Super Bowl. So this is a very important job. We're going to let you go. Mike Arnold is the longtime CBS Sports director. He is the director of Super Bowl 50. He has been on the team with Phil Simms, Jim Nantz, producer Lance Barrow for many years. And like I mentioned during the podcast, Mike has done Olympics. He did the Leitner game, which is pretty incredible, and All-Star games for Major League Baseball. And he's just done a ton of NFL, and he's had an excellent career. He's one of the really talented guys in the business, and that's not just me saying this because he's on the podcast. As people know who listen to this, I talk to a lot of people, and Mike Arnold's reputation is very good away from CBS. Mike, we know it was a busy week. We really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks, Richard. Enjoyed being here.
All right, you listen to the Audible's NFL podcast, and as we're taping this on the Super Bowl week, they have had shows all week from Santa Clara. That's the Audible's NFL podcast. The MMQB features Robert Mays. For the best Super Bowl coverage in podcasting, it's all about SI. Search for the Audible's NFL podcast and the MMQB on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. We're online at si.com/podcast. All right, back in the studio. We'll wrap this up pretty quick. My thanks to Mike Arnold, who took some time to talk to us today on a very busy week. We're taping this on the Wednesday before the Super Bowl, and obviously he's got a busy week, but I really appreciate him taking the time to do that. Thank you so much for the great feedback on these podcasts. The feedback for Jay Williams was incredible. It's by no means the most listened to podcast that we've done, but it may be the podcast that I seemingly hit home the most because people really respected his honesty. And I agree. Jay went to a place on that podcast that most people don't go to. He dropped the BS out and was incredibly honest and transparent. And I really, really appreciate that. Some upcoming podcasts will be Ernie Johnson of Turner Sports, who's a really, really good guy and an interesting guy and obviously works on arguably the greatest studio show ever. Zach Lowe of ESPN, formerly of Grantland, will be a guest in the next couple of weeks. That should be interesting. I will press him on Grantland, and he will probably not answer, but I will do my best. And in, I think, maybe 4 weeks or so, maybe 3 weeks at this point, Gabriel Marcotti, the acclaimed global soccer writer. He's working for ESPN now, works for some European publications as well. He will be a guest on this podcast. And then we'll have other announcements too. But over the next couple of weeks, I think that's where we're headed. My thanks to Mike Arnold. My thanks to Alan Kim. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.